College sports overall are turning a profit in Montana thanks to football. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you about a new way Missoula's two hospitals have found to save money. And in our feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with solar energy expert John Perlin about the history and future of energy from the sun. A report prepared for the Montana Board of Regents says college athletics brought in $50.2 million in 2013, making a $571,000 profit. The report by Accounting and Budgeting Director Frieda Hauser shows the figures are down from 2012, when athletics brought $54 million in revenue and $1.1 million in profit. The University of Montana football program reported a $2.3 million surplus, more than any other football program in the state. Combined, football programs at all state campuses reported $16.7 million in revenue and $13.4 million in spending, resulting in a $3.3 million profit. The Bozeman Daily Chronicle reports basketball programs lost $876,500 and all other sports combined for a loss of $2.2 million. The report will be presented to the Regents at its January 7th meeting in Helena.
And in other news from around the state, the Ravalli County Sheriff says a man died after falling from a 30-foot embankment near the West Fork of the Bitterroot. Sheriff Chris Hoffman told the Ravalli Republic that the man died Friday while apparently attempting to dig out his vehicle, which had become stuck on a remote road. Snowmobilers initially spotted the man's vehicle stuck in the snow on Woods Creek Road. The newspaper reports the snowmobilers tried to light a fire and provide first aid to the man while one went for help. Hoffman says an ambulance crew attempted CPR, but the man was pronounced dead before arriving at the hospital. The sheriff did not immediately release the man's name, but said he lived in the area part-time.
As expected, Missoula's St. Patrick Hospital and Community Medical Center have agreed to contract out their medical air transport services to a company called Northwest MedStar. St. Pat's CEO Jeff Fee says instead of each hospital using a separate helicopter, they will share one helicopter and one fixed-wing aircraft operated by Northwest MedStar.
In fact, Northwest MedStar is going to be investing in a new helicopter, which is going to significantly enhance the actual services that we're able to offer. One of the limitations we currently have with our current existing airframe is the weight and the size challenges we have with isolates for neonatal intensive care unit patients. And the new helicopters are bigger, faster, larger, and certainly are much more capable of flying the special needs patients.
The aircraft will be based at the Missoula County Airport. Life Flight currently has 16 employees, and Fee says those staff will apply to work for Northwest MedStar. Fee says the decision to contract the services was partly financial.
Given the competitive industry that air transport represents and the need for us to maintain high, safe, high-quality patient transport, you really have to have an ongoing commitment to capital as well. And when a helicopter has to compete with patient beds and x-rays and, you know, tongue depressors for capital, it's a much more difficult proposition. And we've definitely needed for some time an upgrade in our actual airframe.
Fee says the move will save St. Pat's about $750,000 a year. Northwest MedStar will take over operations in early April, and there will be no disruption of service.
Lewis and Clark County Commissioners have passed a resolution that says the location of homes will no longer dictate fire suppression tactics or where fire lines are placed. The Missoulian reports the resolution means firefighters will not be obligated to protect a home from wildfire. Sonny Steger is a retired U.S. Forest Service employee and FireSafe Montana board member who helped write the resolution. He says a lot of crews think they must protect homes, and the resolution lets firefighters know they are not obligated to risk their lives to save homes. County commissioners signed the resolution last month. It also directs local crews to receive training in basic wildfire behavior. Steger will teach the first class to volunteer crews in Wolf Creek, Craig, and Dearborn.
Missoula County Attorney Fred Van Valkenburg is scheduled to meet with county officials later this week to discuss the standoff between his office and the Department of Justice. The Justice Department earlier this year reached agreements with the University of Montana and the City of Missoula after investigations revealed deficiencies in how they responded to reports of sexual assault. Those agreements required UM and the city to take several steps to improve their responses. Van Valkenburg, however, has adamantly refused to cooperate with the DOJ, saying the agency has no cause or jurisdiction to initiate such an investigation of his office. This week's county commission schedule has an hour set aside Thursday morning for Van Valkenburg, the county's chief administrative officer, risk manager, and chief civil deputy county attorney, to meet. The commissioner's schedule says the meeting may be closed to the public due to, quote, litigation strategy, end quote. Van Valkenburg today described the meeting as a general discussion and says no new development has occurred.
At this point, there's nothing, but, you know, you never know where things might lead, and because it potentially involves a lawsuit, that's why the proviso is in there about the potential of closing the meeting to discuss litigation strategy.
Van Valkenburg says representatives of his office briefly met with Montana's U.S. attorney a few weeks ago. He says nothing new came out of that meeting. He says his office has been willing to internally scrutinize its handling of sexual assault cases.
We have a kind of an ongoing internal review of what we do. We meet with advocates for victims. We meet with detectives of the police department. We've talked to representatives of other prosecuting attorneys' offices, things like that.
Montana U.S. Attorney Michael Cotter had no comment when contacted today about this week's meeting among Missoula County officials.
Lieutenant Governor John Walsh says he is interested in serving the remainder of U.S. Senator Max Box's term if Box is confirmed as the next ambassador to China. Walsh already has announced his candidacy for Box's seat in the 2014 election. Walsh told Lee Newspapers of Montana Saturday he wants the interim appointment if Baucus leaves before his term expires in January 2015. The Democratic lieutenant governor previously told the Associated Press that he had not thought about an interim appointment. He said at the time that Governor Steve Bullock had not approached him and would not speculate as to what Bullock would do. Walsh faces former Lieutenant Governor John Bollinger and Dirk Adams for the Democratic nomination.
A state official says a new scam is targeting veterans' pensions and disability compensation. Joe Fosker of the Montana Veterans Affairs Department says the scammers seek veterans who want a sum of cash quickly instead of waiting for their monthly payments. He says those veterans are talked into legally signing over their pay for a sum usually far less than what they would accrue over their lifetime.
Say a person receives $500 a month in disability compensation. It may be that through this process, they're offered $10,000 for the rest of that compensation for as long as the veteran lives. Well, this is an illegal thing to happen. But if the veteran will actually sign over a power of attorney to where this middleman, if you will, this entity, can then have the power of attorney to actually create a new direct deposit, because all this is direct deposit pay, a new direct deposit account, these people typically will sell this product, if you will, to other folks.
Foster says he has taken a few calls about the scam, and they advertise as, quote, "Do you want money now?" end quote. He says disability compensation cannot be legally transferred, but the money changes hands so many times that it is hard to track.
Organizers of a predator derby in Idaho say 21 coyotes but no wolves were shot by more than 230 hunters. Steve Alder of Idaho for Wildlife, the weekend event's promoter, said the low tally helps prove sport hunting isn't an effective tool in managing Idaho's wolves. The derby near Salmon in Idaho's mountains proceeded after a fight between its organizers and environmentalists in U.S. District Court. A judge Friday ruled against event foes, including Wild Earth Guardians, who wanted the derby stopped on grounds the U.S. Forest Service hadn't issued a permit. U.S. District Magistrate Judge Candy Dale decided no permit was needed. Alder's group offered two separate $1,000 prizes, one for the hunter who killed the biggest wolf and the other for a hunter who bagged the most coyotes.
Development of solar energy is undergoing a renaissance as the price and downside of fossil fuels increases. Author, physics professor, and solar energy expert John Perlin says the use of solar energy goes back thousands of years. Perlin teaches at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and coordinates the California Space Grant Consortium. The solar energy advocate's latest book is titled Let It Shine, The 6,000-Year Story of Solar Energy. In this feature interview, Perlin talks with News Director Sally Mock about the surprising history of solar energy and its future.
Yeah, that's the thing that struck me was, as I did my research, nobody knew anything about it. What was most fascinating was that it's all in the archives all over the world, but the information's there, but you have to get it.
It even goes back to ancient Chinese using solar energy.
What's really interesting is that the Chinese discovered what's called the gnomon, and that's a stick that goes perpendicular into the ground, and it becomes the first timekeeper and calendar keeper that we had, and it does that by the shadows of the sun throughout the year.
And, of course, over the years, over the centuries, solar energy has taken a far distant seat to fossil fuels, and there are good reasons for that. Fossil fuels were abundant and cheap for a very long time.
Well, actually, fossil fuels are very young, you might say. They're only about 200 or 300 years old. And what a lot of people don't realize is we just think of the West, and we think of the industrialized West, but throughout the world, people were still using solar energy to heat their homes and to also designing properly to keep them cool during the summertime for thousands of years up to today. For example, I was in Western Turkey trekking a few months ago, and I saw like every house was designed as the they were using a solar design, mainly facing the house south, having enough overhang to keep the summer sun off. Very simple designs, but very effective.
In this country, solar energy, it seems like it had its biggest heyday in the 70s. In the wake of the oil embargo, there was great attention to R&D on solar energy. And then that waned as the oil crisis also eased. So where are we today?
Well, actually, that is another very fascinating group of discoveries I made, was that most of the solar technologies were invented in this country, but the majority of the presidential administrations ignored expert advice to go solar because of the influence of the fossil fuel and nuclear industry. But the documents that I became privy to, and I actually have them at my house, begin with the Eisenhower administration when the first effective solar cells were invented, but instead, because of Cold War needs, they went to nuclear power to whitewash, the effects of the fallout from overhead testing. And then under the Nixon administration, there was a report from the National Science Foundation as they were building on an energy plan for the country that solar cells would be much more much safer and also much more effective than nuclear power. But the Nixon administration, because the energy plan was devised by the Atomic Energy Commission, denied that any report such as that existed and decided to put all their, put all their money into breeder reactors, which never, developed. And nuclear power and fossil fuels. And then the Carter administration also got a recommendation from the Department of Defense, which needed solar for its remote needs, which was cheaper than even then back in the 70s for powering generators. But the Carter administration nixed that idea, and that would have jump-started the solar industry. And then during the Reagan administration, they got a report from the very valued consulting firm of Arthur D. Little that the federal government should spend a lot of money on solar because of its value. And they actually not only destroyed all the copies of that report, but warned the people of Arthur D. Little if they allowed any reports to remain extant or spoke about it, they wouldn't get paid for the report.
It sounds like you think there's some kind of conspiracy out there against solar power.
Well, not a conspiracy. conspiracy, just a, it's happening, actually it's happening today. There's, as solar gets more and more effective, which is happening, is that more and more utilities are trying to stop its spread by eliminating what's called net metering, where people get rewarded for putting solar on their rooftops. Net metering means they get paid for the electricity they produce that goes back into the grid.
I was reading a report, it was done in 2006, by the Global Climate and Energy Project out of Stanford, and this is what the report says. It says that currently less than 1% of total electricity from renewables is solar, and the reasons for that are, according to this report, that it's not competitive yet, that the capital costs are too high, that the conversion efficiency is too modest, and that it's too intermittent a source, that the technology is not there to solve that yet.
When was that done?
It was done in 2006.
Yeah, well, 2006 and 13 are completely different years. The price has gone down astronomically from about $4 a watt to under a dollar a watt. And we're in the midst of what's called a solar revolution. If you read the financials, like The Motley Fool, they're talking about this year, solar was the biggest growth industry on the market. The efficiency has gone up from 2006 to about 10%. Now your best panels on the rooftop are 22%. And I know all this because I'm in charge of installing photovoltaics at the University of California, Santa Barbara campus.
Dr. Perlin, do you see that this revolution, as you put it, is going to continue to the point that solar will be much more dominant source of energy in the very near future in this country?
Already. I mean, for example, in 2000, there was less than 1 gigawatt of photovoltaics installed in the world. Today, the cumulative, there's about 130 gigawatts. So that's order of magnitude by 130, right, of increase. And that's because one country, Germany, the government, decided to have a solar-friendly program called the feed-in tariff, where people got rewarded for using solar, and also because the Chinese government put a lot of money into the manufacturing side, and the what was called the efficiency of scaling brought down the price.
So what would you like to see in this country done, Dr. Perlin, to make solar energy more prominent?
Well, first of all, we're in the midst of a big fight. It's counterintuitive who supports solar and who doesn't. The military has always been the biggest supporter in this country of solar since the launching of the Vanguard satellite that uses used photovoltaics, solar cells. And solar cells gave the military a new weapon, and that was space, to monitor what was happening in the world, also to guide its missile system, and to give it a very private communication system. The military has always been a very powerful advocate. In fact, if not for the military, there would be no photovoltaic industry. Then also, the people who started the solar terrestrial industry was Exxon, of all companies, right? And the first applications on land were oil-based assets. In fact, it was photovoltaics that saved the oil industry in Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia had a bad oil spill. And they asked the question, well, actually the king said, if you can't keep our aquifers clean, we will get rid of all the oil rigs. And so they used solar cells to send electricity into the ground to protect the pipelines and the well casings from any corrosion.
And the future is bright as far as you're concerned in terms of solar energy.
Well, not only, you know, we mix up, we use solar energy now almost, as talking about solar electricity, solar cells, but also there's solar water heating. And for example, in China, I think it's about 40 million people, 40 million households, I should say. So it's about 160 million people ready to use solar water heating for their hot water. In fact, there's more energy saved in the world by heating water with the sun than there is with solar electricity.
Well, I have been speaking with Dr. John Perlin, who's a professor of physics at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and coordinator of the California Space Grant Consortium there, and also author of a new book called Let It Shine, The 6,000-Year Story of Solar Energy. Dr. Perlin, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for calling.
John Perlin will give a free lecture on solar energy Wednesday, January 8th at 6 p.m. in the Hager Auditorium of the Museum of the Rockies in Bozeman.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide, there is a winter weather advisory in effect from 8 p.m. this evening till 11 p.m. tomorrow for West Glacier region, the Bitterroot Sapphire Mountains, the Potomac Sealy Lake region, and the lower Clark Fork region. There is also a winter weather advisory in effect from 8 p.m. this evening to 5 p.m. tomorrow for the Kootenai Cabinet region and Flathead Mission Valleys. Tonight's snow will be likely with a chance of light freezing rain and lows in the mid-20s to lower 30s. Tomorrow, snow and rain are likely and a chance of slight freezing rain with highs in the mid-30s to lower 40s. For central Montana, there is also a winter weather advisory in effect until 5 a.m. Wednesday for all of the central Montana. Tonight should be cloudy with a chance of snow and lows 10 to 25 degrees. Tomorrow should be cloudy with a chance of snow through the day and rain likely in the afternoon with highs 25 to 35 degrees. In southwest Montana, there is a winter advisory in effect until 5 a.m. on Wednesday. Tonight, expect cloudy skies and a chance of snow and lows 20 to 35 degrees. And tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and highs 35 to 45 degrees.
Currently in our listening area, Helena is 41 degrees with partly cloudy conditions. In Kalispell, it's cloudy and 31 degrees. Butte has 39 degrees under mostly cloudy skies. Great Falls is cloudy with 44 degrees. Here in Missoula, the temperature under cloudy skies is 35 degrees. It's 31 degrees and clear in Dillon. In Hamilton, it's cloudy and 36 degrees. Libby has 33 degrees with cloudy conditions. And in Polson, skies are cloudy and it's 32 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Tom Power.
One of the most common refrains in discussions of public economic policy is the importance not only of creating jobs, but of creating good jobs, usually meaning jobs with pay levels, benefits, and security that can support a middle-class lifestyle. For several decades following the end of the Great Depression and the Second World War, this usually meant, for blue-collar workers, a unionized manufacturing job with one of the nation's large corporations. For white-collar workers and professionals, it also often meant a job with one of these large national corporations or within a government agency. It was these good jobs, both blue and white-collar, that laid the basis for the expansion of the American middle class to include a very broad swath of American families. By the middle of the 20th century, commentators were talking about the affluent society that had developed as each generation seemed to move up the economic ladder, doing better than their parents had done. At some point over the last several decades, however, that economic pattern, which we had begun to believe was a unique characteristic of economic opportunity in the United States, began to unravel as rapidly as it had been created. The result has been increasingly difficult economic times, not only for blue-collar workers, but also for professionals. More and more families are faced with stagnating or declining economic opportunities, as almost all of the benefits of rising economic productivity have gone to a tiny percentage of the very rich at the top of an increasingly steep economic pyramid. It is easy to blame this on the disappearance of the good jobs on which we previously relied. For instance, the shift of manufacturing jobs from high-wage states in the North and West to low-wage states in the South and Great Plains provide a graphic example of the loss of these good jobs from many communities. As those jobs shifted geographically, wages and benefits fell, and ultimately many of those jobs moved overseas in the pursuit of an even cheaper workforce. That movement of good jobs to poor and poor locations should have taught us that there was nothing inherently high wage or good about those manufacturing jobs. There was an important social and political story behind what had made those jobs good, at least for a while. But it has not just been the outsourcing of manufacturing jobs to poor nations that has undercut worker pay, benefits, and security in the United States. Those jobs that have remained in the United States also have been transformed in a variety of ways that have undermined what was previously attractive about them. The explosion in the use of temporary workers has been part of that path downward. Temporary employment agencies used to primarily provide workers to white-collar occupations that faced uneven demands for their services. Now those temp agencies have become big businesses providing national manufacturing, construction, retail, and service companies with workers at lower wages, no benefits, and absolutely no job security. The temporary workers are not employed by the companies for whom they work. They are employed by the temp agency and loaned to the national firms. This is attractive to national firms because it allows them to adjust their number of temporary workers anytime they want, with no consequences to the firm. This shift away from business leaders taking some responsibility for the well-being of their workers has spread to professional jobs, too. Skilled professionals are being fired and then hired back as independent consultants who are now self-employed. Both private firms and government agencies are taking advantage of this possibility. It allows them to stop paying benefits or even contributing to unemployment and worker disability insurance. Since their workers are not their employees, the company or government agency also has no formal commitment to those workers. There's no such thing as continuity of employment, seniority, or tenure. Even universities have gotten into this game in a big way. Most universities now staff many of their classes with adjunct part-time workers, most of them with advanced degrees, who are paid for the number of courses they teach. These temporary faculty members are kept on very short-term contracts, never knowing if the contracts will be renewed from semester to semester. They are also usually kept at less than half-time so that no benefits have to be paid to them. As a result, many adjunct faculty members commute between several different colleges or other jobs, working part-time at each of them and bringing in an annual income that qualifies them for food stamps. It seems clear that there are no types of jobs that by their very nature provide high pay, good benefits, and relatively secure employment. In the past, we socially created such economic opportunities through implicit and explicit social contracts between workers and employers. We laid the basis for that with regulations that protected the health and safety of workers and their rights to organize and negotiate with employers. We also created social safety nets that protected workers and their families during economic downturns and as they moved from one job to another. That is how the good jobs, whose losses we now mourn, were created in the middle of the 20th century. Those good jobs were not lost by accident. They were consciously destroyed by the deregulation mania of the last several decades, as our political and business leaders have rushed to re-embrace 19th century style laissez-faire capitalism with its intense concentrations of wealth, rampant poverty among the working class, and repeated economic depressions. This is a dangerous and destructive nostalgia for the bad old days that we should have no interest in repeating.
Tom Power is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Valentine. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.